about some of the things that have happened there. Just a reminder, I see several visitors here, so I always feel like I need to kind of bring us to a certain point where we're ready to talk about what we've got ready for today. But Judges is a mess. You know, the proclamations that are made a couple of times in the book of Judges that every man did what was right in his own eyes, I think you can imagine how that's likely to turn out. That's probably not going to end well, and it doesn't in many cases. And during this period of time in between, we might say in between the age of the patriarchs and the age of the kings, is this period where during which God raises up at particular times people to free the Israelites from oppression, times when they've been intentionally by God allowed to lapse into those sorts of moments where they have been punished for their wickedness. So God has done this, and then from time to time, as he hears the people's supplication, he responds to that by bringing deliverance to them. And so you've got this series of judges that we've talked about. We're nearing the end of that right now with Samson. He's not technically the last of the judges, but he is the last of the ones that don't have books specifically allocated to them. We'll talk briefly about Samuel as we kind of conclude this series in a couple of weeks. But this is Samson as pictured in Branson, Missouri. He's the one on the top. We were there this weekend and went and saw an adaptation of Samson's story at one of the theaters there, and they did some interesting things with that. It had some perspectives that I think are different than the way that I've usually pictured Samson. I'm not going to declare which one of us is right about that. I'll just say anytime they try to tell the story of a biblical character, they're going to have to add some details, and whether or not they added them exactly right is perhaps open to some interpretation. But today, we're going to talk about, at once, the most familiar part of Samson's story and also the end of Samson's story. I think we probably, over the last couple of weeks, talked more about some things in Samson's life that were unfamiliar to us. And today, we're going to come and talk about a series of events that really provides Samson's best-known moments and also the end, as I said, of his story. Samson, we already saw, had judged the Israelites for 20 years in his particular sphere of influence. And so he's not a young man. We don't know exactly his age during any of this. We do know, however, that earlier on he has already sought a wife, and so he's no longer a boy at that time. And then he has judged Israel for 20 years. One would think he is at least in his 40s at this point. That doesn't seem all that old to me at this point, but it does seem like somebody who might have achieved a certain level of restraint, self-control, and wisdom. That did not happen in Samson's case, apparently, at all, ever. This age that he has attained, whatever at this point is, has not prevented him from continuing to make these same mistakes over and over and over again. You'll recall last time I said we tend to think that Samuel's main problem was women. Samuel's problem was not women. Samuel's problem was a lack of self-control. He just simply did what Samson wanted to do at any given moment. And when you live your life that way, a lot of things are going to cause trouble for you. Women are exhibit A in Samson's life, obviously, because his pursuit of women in this unrestrained sort of way continue to cause him to make similar mistakes over and over and over again. However, it could easily have been something else. As a matter of fact, there are plenty of somethings else in Samson's story, times when he made bad choices in other ways that did not involve women, but his best-known, most famous stories are related to that. So he just continues to make these same mistakes over and over again. And as chapter 16 opens, we see yet another illustration of that. Samson went to Gaza, and there he saw a prostitute, and he went into her. There's so much in that one verse that just kind of encapsulates Samson's way of doing life. He saw something, he wanted it, so he had it. And I mean, just over and over and over again in his story, that's what we see. He sees something, he wants it, so he just does whatever he's got to do to have it. I mentioned last time a couple of things. First of all, Manoah, Samson's dad, and Samson's mom, who is nameless in this record, were glad to have him. Remember, they had been childless, and God miraculously intervenes in order to allow them to have children. And so they've waited a period of time, obviously, for this to happen. And so when Samson comes, it appears that they give him, they know he's special. Obviously, the prophecies that are made to his mom and then repeated that she is able to tell Manoah, Samson's dad, are that the boy is going to be special. He would have been special even if he had not been a Nazarite, even if he had not had supernatural strength. I think his parents, he was special because he was theirs and they'd waited so long for him. And as sometimes happens, they are very permissive and indulgent and help to sort of, to some degree, maybe create this monster that we see in Scripture without any moral compass and any self-restraint. I'm not going to blame them for that. Everybody's responsible for their own actions, but you know, there perhaps are some connections there. This is not a class on parenting. I'm just saying, take a look at Samson and note that here's a boy who grew up without ever maybe having been told, oh, no, you don't. Yes, I can is his motto, and so he does pretty much what he wants at every turn along the way. And so when he comes to Gaza and he sees this woman, he says, yes, I can. And so he goes into her. There's almost no commentary on this at all. It's almost as if it's a matter of course. As you can almost picture the writer of Judges saying, Samson went into Gaza, and there he saw a prostitute, and he went into her, comma, of course he did. You know, because that's just the way that he is. He does not stop to check whether or not this is a good thing to do, or whether this is consistent with his profession of faith, or whether this is something that would yield consequences that were desirable. He just acts on his impulses. So, this he does. Remember, Samson is famous, as a person would be when he has the kind of abilities that Samson has, and he is well known in his area, and he has become public enemy number one for the Philistines, so they are tracing his movements. They're constantly monitoring him to see where he's going, what he's doing, and whether there might be some opportunity for them to shut him down. And so they have noted his location here. You've got this terrible combination of unrestrained lust along with dysfunctional relational skills, as I put on the slide behind me. At the same time, he's got this tremendous physical power that makes him virtually unstoppable. And that's what we see here. In this case, the Gazites were told, Samson has come here, and so, verse 2, they surrounded the place, set an ambush for him all night at the gate of the city. They kept quiet all night, saying, let's wait until the light of the morning, and then we'll kill him. So, somebody apparently fell asleep at switch, or his physical power was just so overwhelmingly impressive that they couldn't stop him, but you know, I'm going to make sure I'm not ready for that yet. You know what happens here. Samson lays there till midnight. At midnight, he gets up. He took hold of the gate of the city and the two posts and pulled them up and carried them, put them on his shoulders, and carried them to the top of the hill that's in front of Hebron. Now, we're not talking about just carrying up the height of the nearest hill. This man carried this gate miles, perhaps 20 miles or more. He carried these things, these big, huge city gates. And I don't know whether, I'm trying to picture, this is dark, okay, but I'm trying to picture what these guards are doing at this moment. As I mean, they're sitting there waiting and watching lest he leave surreptitiously. This he does not do. Instead, in the side of them all, he just picks up the city gates right at the spot where these people are waiting. He picks them up and just carries them away. I'm about now to do an impression of the guards at this moment. Ready? What do you do in a moment like that? Do you attack this guy who's carrying these gates out? I mean, his strength is just, I don't know what they do. At any rate, and that's kind of the end of the story. This is supposed to be the end of his story in their minds, but instead it just becomes the end of one more strange, bizarre chapter in Samson's life. The Bible gives no further commentary on this. It doesn't say, and then they said, rats, or anything like that. He does this. I think, as if you read this, the book of Judges, as a book, there's a reason why things are put together the way they are. And the reason may well be that this serves as sort of a preface to help us understand this story of Samson from a variety of different perspectives. For example, it helps us understand why the Philistines are eager to devise this scheme with Delilah that we're going to see next, because they've just not been able, they know now that his strength is such that merely ambushing him is insufficient. This is not going to work. Further, it helps us understand something from the writer's perspective about Samson himself. In other words, he's made no progress in terms of his restraint. When you see him, therefore, fall in love with Delilah and what that does to him, you say, okay, well, yeah, this is not surprising. Just a few moments ago, we read this stuff about this woman from Gaza. And so this kind of gets us ready for this extended narrative that we see next. I'm going to go back to this slide. Just a reminder, unrestrained lust, dysfunctional relational skills, and unstoppable physical power. These things are all a part of the equation, and they come to bear in the story of Delilah in a dramatic way as well. All right, so here's the way this opens in verse 4. After this, he loved a woman in the valley of Sorek, whose name was Delilah. Obviously, this is not the same woman that he's been involved with just a few moments ago in the story. So he goes, he sees this woman. This reminds me an awful lot of what happens with his first wife. You know, he just sees a woman. She looks good to him. And so this is the start of this relationship. The problem is that this woman is not honorable. We don't know anything much about her except that she is very open to bribery, which is what ends up happening. The Philistines bribe her to seduce Samson and to find out the secret of his strength. Tell us where his great strength lies and by what means we may overpower him, that we may bind him to humble him, and we will each give you 1,100 pieces of silver. So there's a lot of money involved in this. So we don't know how many of these lords of the Philistines there were, but a number of them, and each of them is going to give her 1,100 pieces of silver. So this is a significant bribe. Some things we know about Delilah already. Okay, first of all, she is sympathetic to the needs or wishes of her own people, Philistines. And so, therefore, when they come to visit her about this, she is receptive to this scheme. So, second of all, we know that before this even starts, before the relationship or as this relationship is even starting, she already is willing to sacrifice the relationship for the sake of gain. All right, so she's gonna do what's necessary here in order to deliver Samson. And that, Dane, it's hard for me now because we've just seen this little play recently, you know, and they make Delilah out as almost a, she really loved Samson, but she was in dire financial straits, and so they come to her with this money, and there's nothing like that in the narrative here. She just is a willing participant in this scheme to get rid of Samson. The Bible never says that Delilah loved Samson, only that Samson loved Delilah. Whether or not she ever had much interest in him beyond this scheme, we do not know. But she begins to try to come up with the reasons for this, and she tries three different times unsuccessfully, as you well know. We'll take a look at this as we go through. Let's go verse 6 first. Delilah said to Samson, "Please tell me where your great strength lies and how you might be bound that one could subdue you." I'm trying to picture myself being Samson here. What a knucklehead. The word knucklehead does not appear in any of the translations that I've ever seen, but I mean, not exactly subtle here, right? Delilah says, say for example, somebody really wanted to kind of immobilize you. How could that happen? Theoretically, not that I know any people nearby who would be interested in such a thing. If she had said simply, you know, I'm in awe of your strength. And I wonder how it is that a person gets to be the fine physical specimen that you are. You hunk of manhood. You know, like I said, just even the way she approaches this, just I'm even as oblique as I can sometimes be, I think I'd have said, wait a minute, what are you trying to do here? But apparently this let's put it this way, if this ever occurs to Samson, there's no record of any response from him on this. I see what you're trying to do here. No, nothing like that. Maybe he does know. Obviously, he hides it from her, whether it's at this point he does not yet trust her or whether he thinks maybe she is trying to do something against him. We just don't know. But at any rate, he says, well, here's what you could do. If someone were to bind me with 7 fresh bowstrings that have not been dried, then I shall become weak and be like any other man. At this point, Samson's pants are on fire. Okay? Those of you who are not tuned in, liar, liar, pants on fire. Okay, so he tells her a lie. This is not good. It's not good to lie. Then the lords of the Philistines brought her 7 fresh bowstrings, had not been dried, verse 8. She bound him with them, and then she had men lying in ambush in the inner chamber, and she said to him, the Philistines are upon you, Samson. But he snapped the bowstrings as a thread of flax snaps when it touches the fire. So the secret of his strength was not known. All right, we're not surprised by that. All of us have read this story several times. So she is taking his word for it, and she has people lying in ambush here. Samson gets up, snaps the bowstrings. That did not work in any way. Now, here's the part where it really gets interesting to me. Unbelievable, right? You see this. Verse 10, Delilah said to Samson, you've mocked me, and you told me lies. Please tell me how you might be bound. What is wrong with Samson? He now knows what she's trying to do. The first time he could at least plead ignorance, but now he has seen the events unfold where she has had people lying in wait. And the Bible, to be fair, the Bible doesn't say that Samson ever knew that the Philistines were lying in ambush, only that he woke up when he thought they were there and destroyed the bindings. We don't know that for sure. But still, clearly, she is doing something here. She is either trying to harm him or she is just she's playing with him, toying with him, it would seem to me. Of course, I know how the story turns out, so maybe I've got an advantage here, but still. He said, okay, verse 11. Sorry about that. But if they bind me with new ropes that have not been used, then I shall become weak and be like any other man. So Delilah took new ropes and bound it with him and said to him, the Philistines are upon you, Samson. The men lying in ambush were in an inner chamber, but he snapped the ropes off his arms like a thread. Okay, so attempt number 2, that didn't work out very well either. New ropes didn't do the trick. Delilah said to Samson, until now you've mocked me and told me lies. Tell me how you might be bound. So he said, he's getting closer, by the way. Are you noticing this? If you weave the 7 locks of my head with web and fasten it tight with a pin, then I shall become weak and be like any other man. All right, so lie number 3. While he sleeps, Delilah takes the 7 locks of his head, wove them into the web, and she made them tight with a pin, and then says, the Philistines are upon you, Samson. But he awoke from his sleep and pulled away the pin, the loom, and the web, whole business. And so that didn't work. Now she pulls out the big guns. She pouts. She said to him, verse 15, how can you say I love you when your heart is not with me? You've mocked me these 3 times and you've not told me where your great strength lies. So the pouting comes first. After that, what comes? The nagging. Okay? And she pressed him with her words day after day and urged him. His soul was vexed to death. Does it ever occur to Samson that maybe this woman is not good for him and that he ought to run away very fast? Maybe he could grab some gates from some cities and take them with him to Hebron or something. But no, he just puts up with it. Finally, he says, okay, here's the deal. The strength is indeed associated with my hair. And if I didn't have this hair, then I wouldn't be strong. A razor has never come upon my head, verse 17, for I have been a Nazarite to God from my mother's womb. If my head is shaved, then my strength will leave me, and I shall become weak and be like any other man. You know, this is interesting, isn't it? Do you recall back when we first come to know of Samson, and there's the Nazarite vow given not only to Samson, but also to his mom? Both of them have to remain separate from all these kinds of things. And one of the things that's associated with that is that Samson is not supposed to cut his hair. There's nothing in that early narrative that directly connects Samson's hair with his strength. But he has come to know this somehow or another. I think the key to it is what he says when he says, a razor has never come upon my head, for I have been a Nazarite to God from my mother's womb. In other words, he knows that he is special because of that connection to God, a connection which is marked by the vow, one of the key elements of which is that he would not cut his hair. So he understands that he is the way he is, lock, stock, and barrel, because of this devotion to God. And so if that vow is broken, then he would perceive that his source of strength would be removed at that point. So that's what he says. And he's correct on that, obviously. If my head is shaved, then my strength will leave me. I'll become weak and like any other man. Verse 18 says, Delilah saw that he had told her all his heart. I don't know what the difference is, because really at surface level, this sounds just like the things that he's already told her. So there's something about the way that he reveals this to her, perhaps a reference to this story of his life, even the vow that was given to him even from the time of his mother's womb. She realizes that he has been truthful with her this time. And so she calls the Lord of the Philistines, saying, come up again, for he has told me all his heart. Then the lords of the Philistines came up to her and brought money in their hands. Okay, let me stop right there for just a minute. This scenario is unfolding differently even now, right? It appears that these first three occasions were all Delilah, that she had arranged for these people to come in and lay in wait. These were three tests. If she had been successful with any of them, then she would have known then that she could have called the Philistine lords and that they would have then arranged for the ambush. But this time is different, because now she calls them directly. They bring her money. See, she wasn't going to take the chance on that till she was sure. So they bring her the money, and they come with the people who are going to take Samson in custody. So the lords of the Philistines come, bring the money in their hands. Then she makes him sleep on her knees, and she calls a man and had him shave off the seven locks of his head. Okay, so at this point, Samson appears to be very trusting of her still. Why, I do not know. It doesn't seem like to me that that's a very understandable sort of thing, but he trusts her, so she falls asleep on her lap. He falls asleep on her lap, and that I can just picture her just comforting him and just gradually getting him to fall asleep, and then she said, she has this guy come, and he cuts off Samson's hair. Can I confess to you that until the last couple days, I had never noticed that she had somebody else come in and cut his hair? I've always pictured her cutting off Samson's hair herself, but she doesn't. The text is clear here that she has somebody else that she's arranged to come in and cut off Samson's hair. What that looks like, I don't know. Earlier, there's a reference to these seven locks or braids that he has, you know, of hair, whether or not he just chopped them off, but it's also the word shaved is involved in this. So it would appear maybe that this is a rather time-consuming process. Samson is obviously a very deep sleeper, because I can't imagine you coming in trying to give me a haircut while I'm sleeping, but that worked for him one way or another. So rather unceremoniously, shaves off the 7 locks of his head, begins to torment him. Talk about kicking a man when he's down. But she's looking to see if this is real. And so the tormenting, basically assuming, comes in this form of, the Philistines are upon you, Samson, the same as the previous 3 experienced. And he rose from his sleep, and the writer of Judges gives us some commentary here, tells us what Samson's thinking. I'm going to get up, and I'm going to do as I did at other times, and I will shake myself free. But he did not know that the Lord had left him. Okay, so there's some timing issues here that are kind of difficult for us to sort out, perhaps. In this case, the Bible doesn't say that she bound him or that anybody else bound him, but he says, I tried to shake myself free, and so obviously he's bound in one way or another. Or maybe this is after the Philistines are holding him and he thinks he'll shake himself free. Maybe that's what it is. But at any rate, he's not able to do that because, as he himself had understood to be the case, once his hair was cut, his strength was gone. And I don't know whether he hasn't realized yet that his hair has been cut. I don't sit around thinking, is my hair still up there or not? You know, so maybe that's unknown to him at this point. But at any rate, the Philistines then seize him, gouge out his eyes, and I use the phrase, they treat him like an animal, because you picture him, they've got him grinding at the mill. You picture one of these big, huge mills. That may not be the case where, you know, you've got, you know, horses or oxen or donkeys or something pulling this thing around. That may not be the case. They may just have him with a mortar and a pestle right there in some kind of a big stone pot. At any rate, he is having to do something he's never had to do before in his life. He has always been able to have his way, do what he wants, and basically other people are going to surround him and treat him as if he's something special. Not today. Now he is at the wishes of others around him, so he's just grinding at the mill. In verse 22, which we'll talk about again in just a moment, which the writer of Judges kind of just throws in almost parenthetically, but his hair started to grow. The hair of his head again began to grow after it had been shaved. Okay, so that's the story of Samson and Delilah, a very, very familiar story to us, as is the next part of Samson's story. But let me stop for just a moment. Observations that you have or things that you would like to share or ask about related to Samson's story at this point. They didn't mention the prostitutes and things like that, no. I didn't show. Yeah. Yeah, there's a lot of cruelty in this story, and you know, those seldom show up in the third grade curricula. But yeah, we don't even want to get into Tom Jones here. He's got his own story. But anyway, there's so much about this that is just, to some degree, it's a part of the trajectory of Samson's life. You know, he has just continually made these bad choices, and he's continued to allow his unrestrained lust to determine the course of his life. And ultimately, he is exactly where things like this take you to. It's not good, and I think it's appropriate for us to feel sorry for people who have made, you know, I don't think it's ever appropriate to say, well, finally got his just desserts. No, I mean, if people have made a mess out of their lives, we ought to feel pity for them. It's okay for us to feel pity for Samson, but the question you want to ask is, why did his story turn out like that? And do I want to do the things he did if that's the way it turns out? I mean, that's one of the things that I think we learn from the judges over and over and over again, is that when people do the things that come natural to them, and they make a mess out of their lives and the consequences are undesirable, rather than sit around saying, well, shame on them, we ought to be thinking, what are the comparisons with my own life story? How do I avoid putting myself in a situation where this is the kind of thing that ultimately becomes my story? Mike? All right, I don't know how much you heard of what Mike had to say, but Mike calls our attention to the fact that Samson's name listed along with so many of our other heroes of faith in Hebrews chapter 11, and that Samson's parents were hand-selected to be the people who would give birth to him and raise him, and they are people of faith, and Samson shows up in that, and Mike said, you know, sometimes it makes you wonder whether God just knows that we're all going to kind of make a big mess out of our lives anyway, and, you know, what are we to make out of that? And he asked what my opinion was, which is a very dangerous thing to do to a preacher, as you all know. But I've thought an awful lot about that, as you have, all of you, I'm sure, because this is the name of a guy like Jephthah and other of the judges. You think, okay, I believe I would have edited his name out of that Hebrews chapter 11 thing. It doesn't seem to fit with great men like Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. But when, you know, you think about every one of those characters, with the possible exception of Abel, who we just don't know very much about except for that one story, most of those guys are flawed and have weaknesses, and they've got, I mean, Abraham's a liar, you know, and we've got just all these people whose stories are not, you know, ultimately good in so many respects. But what's Hebrews chapter 11 praising? It's praising faith. And whatever else you might want to say about these people, they are people of faith. Even at this moment that we're going to read about in the next section of Scripture, Samson has faith. He prays to God and says, God, would you act in this moment? And he believes that he will. And so this Hebrews chapter 11 is not a wholesale endorsement of the lives of the people mentioned. It is an example of how powerful faith can be, even in the lives of flawed people like that. And so while that's not an ultimate response to the mess that we see throughout, I think it's important for us to acknowledge that we are supposed to praise God, not the people that God uses, and that God can indeed so powerfully work through the lives of these people. It's very much like Paul's story, where after his thorn in the flesh was persisted despite his requests, God tells him, my strength is made perfect in weakness. And so I think that those characters that we see there, we look up to them not because they are wholly different from us, but because they're so much the same as us, and yet God is able to use them. To me, that gives hope for that. If God can use Samson, he can use anybody. If the small amount of faith that Samson seems to have is enough to bring about powerful results, then maybe the amount of faith that we have can bring about powerful results as well. Yeah, I'm sorry, excuse me. Yeah, there's a lot of unknowns about things, but I think two or three things that we can see from here, and like I said, we'll close this out in just a few minutes with this last event in Samson's life. But God is always present. God does not always endorse all of the things we do, but He remains very near and fully accessible to those who would, in any small amount, profess faith and allow Him to act in their lives. That doesn't constitute an endorsement. It just tells us something about God, that He is always there, that He is always ready to act. And when we see this last scene, let's put it this way. If God were inclined ever to distance Himself from anybody, surely Samson would have been on His short list. Everything Samson gets himself involved in is selfish and ungodly, moment by moment. But yet God is not far from him. That's what Paul tells the Athenians, right? He is not far from any one of us. In Him we live and move and have our being, just as your own poets have said. Samson here, despite his unrestrained lusts and the mess that he's made of his life, still is able to call out to God. Maybe it's just me. If somebody would like to try to find something a little more noble in Samson than I'm able to find, please feel free to share that. But even at this moment, he's still thinking about himself, isn't he? He prays to God. That's faith. I mean, it's real. So I don't mean to say that the faith is not real. But he prays to God, and he says, empower me to get revenge for these who have gouged out my eyes. Now, God may use it for something else. Please understand that just because that's what Samson's thinking about doesn't mean that's what God's thinking about. You understand that it has been the wish of God to purge the land of the Philistines since He first sent Joshua and his armies into the land all those years back. So this is consistent with the will of God to destroy the Philistines. Further, this is an opportunity for God to demonstrate His power as the Nazirite vow is to some degree reinstated as Samson's hair regrows. And now God is able to act without violating His own contract with Samson. So there's a sense in which God can use this for good things, even though Samson is still thinking selfishly. So don't lose what happens here in the mud of Samson's life. Samson does indeed profess faith in his prayer. And at that moment, despite what Samson is interested in seeing happening, God does what God is interested in seeing happening. So Samson prays to God for strength, and God delivers as Samson pushes these pillars of this temple, killing 3,000 of them that were gathered, verse 27 says. The summary statement is that Samson killed more at this moment than he had during the rest of his life, verse 30. So Samson's mighty acts culminate in this moment, at which time he himself was killed along with them. Verse 31 says, his brothers and all his family came down, took him and brought him up, and buried him between Zorah and Eshtaol in the tomb of Manoah, his father, and he judged Israel 20 years. That statement repeated from the previous chapter. So, Samson's story is one of unrestrained selfishness and power. I've said several times to different people through the years, if one wanted to know exactly how to live a godly life, one way to do that would simply be to take a look at Samson's life and do exactly the opposite almost every time, because he is constantly doing things that are more about Samson and his wishes and lusts than he is about the things of God. This does not negate the powerful things that God does in response to Samson's expression of faith in this moment. But it is a sobering reminder to us to make sure that our lives are not characterized by the things that characterized his life. All right, we'll go on and continue with chapter 17, and we'll conclude the book of Judges. with Samuel here in the next couple of weeks. Thanks.